Well, it's a couple of minutes after, so we'll proceed. A great good morning to you all. As always, it's so good to see you. Just a couple of announcements. Tomorrow is, of course, Christmas Eve. And so our Christmas Eve service will begin at 7 p.m. after RIT. We'll start with a short worship, one that is traditional in the Ramakrishna order, not a very formal worship at all, just a short, very loving worship of Lord Jesus. Then just a short talk, and the topic of the talk will be, and he appeared, and the soul felt its worth. It's from that hymn, O Holy Night. He appeared, and the soul felt its worth. What does it mean to have an avatar come to us? Why does it lift us up? Just a short talk. Then we'll have our regular Christmas Eve service that was written by my grandmother in 1949. She was a Methodist minister before women were Methodist ministers. She kind of snuck in through the side door. She was very much a minister, though. And this is a beautiful little, very traditional Christmas Eve service about the Annunciation and the advent of Christ and so on. And we sing Christmas carols. If any of you that's sitting here this morning feels like singing Ave Maria tomorrow evening, please do send me an email to that effect. We always need someone to sing Ave Maria, and that's a solo. The rest of the congregation doesn't sing with that one. The other carols and hymns are congregational singing. So anyway, that's tomorrow evening. And after we finish in here, we go in the chapel. We go in the monastery for prasad and some more singing of Christmas carols and just general bathing in the joy of having this celebration of an avatar's birth. On December 30th, we'll celebrate Sri Sharada Devi's birthday, Holy Mother. Dhruva will be here to both give us a short talk on Holy Mother. He always brings us something new and interesting, something that you don't find in the books. So he'll be here both to do that and to serve as our pujari. And afterwards, of course, we'll have our potluck prasad lunch. Then on January, there was midnight meditation that night also. The next night, December 31st, we'll have a midnight meditation. Starts at 11:30, goes to 12:06. Then we go in the monastery for a bit. And then later that same day, we'll have our, at 2:30 in the afternoon, we'll have our Kalpataru Day celebration. Celebration of the gift of Sri Ramakrishna's grace to those 30 or so devotees who were with him on that January 1st in 1886. And then the promise that grace extends to us as well. So that's it for the announcements. Next week we'll have some announcements about what's going to happen in the rest of the next year. Because there's so much to cover this morning, there will be no song. And for those of you, and I'm sure some of you do remember, there was a promise that there would be illustrations projected. I simply did not take time to do that. With everything else that happened this weekend, I did not. It's prepared, but it was just getting all of the projection equipment set up and so on. So you'll find, if you go to the website when this talk is posted, you'll find the images in the PDF that's on there. So there will be I also have the book, the beautiful, beautiful book, the centennial edition of The Wizard of Oz, that I took a lot of this from. It's on the table in the monastery. So if you want to take a look at it, it's really beautiful. So this morning's topic, of course, is Swamiji's Raja Yoga and The Wizard of Oz, Part 2, The Story Baum Told. Just as a preface, December is a month for the study of Raja Yoga, a spiritual path often called the Yoga of Meditation. As a Raja Yogi, you use ancient, proven spiritual techniques to claim control of your attention and quiet your mind. Those things that are, as the Swami pointed out in both his Friday evening and Saturday morning talks, we must have a calm mind to meditate. So Raja Yoga has, as part of it, of those things that he spoke about, as well as other things. Regular daily practice of Raja Yoga increases your ability to concentrate and may lead to meditation. This meditation can unite you with the divine presence, the source of your being, and liberate you from the cycle of rebirth and death. Within that context, this morning's talk is about a fairy tale. Now, many of you were here for the last talk, the first talk on this subject, but for those of you who weren't, I will, and it's good to repeat it anyway, because these things need to sink deep. Albert Einstein said, "If you want your children to be intelligent, read them fairy tales. If you want them to be more intelligent, read them more fairy tales." Why? Fairy tales deal in the realm of fantasy. They don't project in imagination things that we already know into some larger frame. This journey that Dorothy takes, as you'll hear, is a fantastic journey. It's not something, Oz doesn't even seem to exist in an earthly sense. The people and the creatures that live there are very different. The animals talk, for example. Scarecrows talk. This realm of fantasy, Albert Einstein was very taken with fantasy. He said that he was capable of doing what he did in terms of breakthroughs in quantum and relativistic physics, because of his gift of fantasy, and that's how he spoke of it. So this is why Albert Einstein said what he said about fairy tales. The Library of Congress declared The Wizard of Oz America's greatest and best-loved homegrown fairy tale. Published in 1900, it is still an all-time best-selling book of children's literature. More than 3 million copies had already been sold by the time it entered the public domain in 1956. Today, we will look closely at the characters and many significant events of L. Frank Baum's fairy tale. Dorothy, a young girl, and her dog Toto make a wondrous journey from the plains of Kansas to the land of Oz, and miraculously home again. As the story is told, she and all three of her extraordinary companions are utterly transformed. We will see how the spiritual principles and practices of karma, jnana, bhakti, and raja yoga, as taught by Swami Vivekananda, are woven into the fabric of Baum's story. Baum was strongly influenced by Swami Vivekananda. A student of theosophy, Baum and his family lived in Chicago in 1893. they eagerly looked forward to the Parliament of World Religions. Baum, his wife, and mother-in-law were in the audience on September 11, 1893, when Vivekananda received a long-standing ovation after the Swami said simply, "Sisters and Brothers of America." Baum attended more of Vivekananda's talks and later was captivated, and I mean captivated, he really was entranced by Swamiji's best-selling book, Raja Yoga, published in 1896. 4 years later, The Wizard of Oz, 4 years later in 1900, The Wizard of Oz sold out its first edition even before it came off the press. This is from yogananda.net. Swami Vivekananda's Raja Yoga, published in 1896, became a bestseller and had a lasting impact on American culture. One small example, Frank Baum, author of The Wizard of Oz, heard Vivekananda speak in Chicago and was deeply moved. Baum's biographer, Evan Schwartz, argues that the quest of Dorothy, the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Cowardly Lion are allegories for the four yogic paths that Vivekananda elaborated. They are allegories for the four yogic paths that Vivekananda elaborated. Just something from last time we talked about this. Dorothy is from the Greek Dorontheia. It means a gift of God. And a gift of God, of course, is human life itself. Dorothy is the every person for us that is having this adventure. The Wizard of Oz is a tale of transformation. Transformation from ordinary consciousness, symbolized by the dreary gray landscape of Kansas, to spiritual awareness, self-awareness. This transformation takes place in a magical realm populated by all the familiar characters of fairy tale: a wizard, witches, helpful friends and fiendish foes, and the challenging trials and challenges that make Dorothy's time in Oz interesting and meaningful. As we will hear by the end of Baum's fairy tales, all four main characters, Dorothy and her companions, the Scarecrow, the Tin Woodman, and the Cowardly Lion, are transformed from a state of ignorance to a state of greater wisdom and illumination. So there's going to be a good bit of reading this morning. That's why I didn't take time for a song. This is from chapter one, the opening of this story. And in our context, this is a description of Dorothy's life in samsara, the life of the ordinary consciousness, the life of the ordinary world. This is now the quote. Dorothy lived in the midst of the great Kansas prairies with Uncle Henry, who was a farmer, and Aunt Em, who was a farmer's wife. Their house was small, for the lumber to build it had to be carried by wagon many miles. There were four walls, a floor, and a roof, which made one room, and this room contained a rusty-looking cook stove, a cupboard for the dishes, a table, three or four chairs, and the beds. Uncle Henry and Aunt Em had a big bed in one corner, and Dorothy a little bed in another corner. There was no garret at all, and no cellar, except a small hole dug in the ground called a cyclone cellar, where the family could go in case one of those great whirlwinds arose, mighty enough to crush any building in its path. The cellar was reached by a trap door in the middle of the floor, from which a ladder led down into a small dark hole. When Dorothy stood in the doorway and looked around, she could see nothing but the great gray prairie on every side. Not a tree nor a house broke the broad sweep of flat country that reached to the edge of the sky in all directions. The sun had baked the plowed land into a gray mass, with little cracks running through it. Even the grass was not green, for the sun had burned the tops of the long blades till they were the same gray color to be seen everywhere. Once the house had been painted, but the sun blistered the paint, and the rains washed it away, and now the house was as dull and gray as everything else. When Aunt Em came to live there, she was a young, pretty wife. The sun and wind had changed her, too. They had taken the sparkle from her eyes and left them a sober gray. They had taken from her her red cheeks and lips, and they were gray also. She was thin and gaunt and never smiled now. When Dorothy, who was an orphan, first came to her, Aunt Em had been so startled by the child's laughter that she would scream and press her hand upon her heart whenever Dorothy's merry voice reached her ears. And she still looked at the little girl with wonder that she could find anything to laugh at. Uncle Henry never laughed. He worked hard from morning till night and did not know what joy was. He was gray also, from his long beard to his rough boots, and he looked stern and solemn and rarely spoke. It was Toto that made Dorothy laugh and saved her from growing as gray as her other surroundings. Toto was not gray. He was a little black dog with long silky hair and small black eyes that twinkled merrily on either side of his furry wet nose. Toto played all day long, and Dorothy played with him and loved him dearly. Now, it's interesting, this name Toto, just as the name Dorothy has significance, Toto does also. The literal translation of Toto is a small animal, particularly a young animal like this little dog is. But because, as we'll see, Frank Baum is very given to wordplay, and even in a child, what is nominally a child's story, Toto is also from in toto, that is, Toto represents everything. He is not only everything to Dorothy, but as we'll see, he is a remarkable little creature that really does come forward and make himself felt. He's the one who reveals the fact that the Wizard of Oz is a humbug. The Wizard of Oz, of course, as we'll discover, is allegorically Maya. The Wizard of Oz, this great humbug that produces these wonders, he does it by sleight of hand and magic, and he's allegorically Maya. Now, the beginning of Dorothy's journey. As you may recall, her adventure starts with a cyclone, which we now call a tornado. As I said last time, within Native American spirituality, with which Baum was quite familiar, this being taken up and whirled about and set down again in a different place is something that happens when you experience a kind of illumination. We might call it psychic illumination rather than spiritual illumination. But as Swami Prabhavananda said, that may be a distinction without a difference. In the terms that we're talking about. So in other words, this cyclone has also an allegorical significance. It takes Dorothy up from this landscape that was just described, this samsara, and sets her down in some place entirely different, as we'll hear. The cyclone had set the house down very gently for a cyclone, in the midst of a country of marvelous beauty. There were lovely patches of greensward all about, with stately trees bearing rich and luscious fruits. Banks of gorgeous flowers were on every hand, and birds with rare and brilliant plumage sang and fluttered in the trees and bushes. A little way off was a small brook, rushing and sparkling along between green banks, and murmuring in a voice very grateful to a little girl who had lived so long in the dry, gray prairies. So this is the description of the place where Dorothy is set down. It could not be more different than the Kansas she came from. And as you may recall, what happens is when the house falls out of the sky onto the ground, it kills the Wicked Witch of the East. Now, this was not in any way intended by Dorothy, but just look at what happens when we start our spiritual journey. Remarkable things happen when we are caught up in our spiritual journey. So the first thing that happens is that Dorothy's house falls on the Wicked Witch of the East. And out of this comes not only the death, as we'll hear, of someone who's been very wicked indeed to the people she's ruled over, but she is a magical being, and she leaves to Dorothy, not intentionally, but she leaves to Dorothy her magic shoes. In the movie, these became ruby slippers because it was one of the first Technicolor movies, and it was a beautiful rendition in color of this story. The people who made the movie thought, oh, let's make Dorothy's shoes glittering ruby color instead. Much more impressive than silver on the screen. But as we'll see, this whole story is about already having what you think you need to have. Already having it, as Vivekananda points out over and over again in his talks, which Baum very much assimilated. The divinity is already within. The knowledge is already within. The love and compassion are already within. The selflessness are already within. All that remains for us to do, and for Dorothy and her companions to do, is dispel their ignorance that this is the case. The reason I bring this up is these magic shoes, though Dorothy doesn't know it at the time, she comes to find, always had the power to grant her wish. And we'll find out what her wish is as we go along. So, chapter 2 of the book is the council with the Munchkins. Among the Munchkins, who are these people who are all about the size that Dorothy is. Dorothy's about a 12-year-old girl. So all of even the adults of this part of Oz are only this tall, was about the same size as her. Even the adult sorceresses and witches are the same size. So among the people who greet Dorothy is the good witch of the north. Her name is Glinda. Glinda. And this is Glinda speaking. "You are most welcome, noble sorceress, to the land of the Munchkins. We are so grateful to you for having killed the wicked witch of the east and setting our people free from bondage." Notice the use of the word bondage. The first thing that Dorothy does, though unintentionally, simply by doing what she's doing, she sets others free from bondage. We'll get to how powerful that is. Dorothy listened to this speech with wonder. What could the little woman being the good witch of the north, what could the little woman possibly mean by calling her a sorceress and saying that she had killed the wicked witch of the east? Dorothy was an innocent, harmless little girl who had been carried by a cyclone many miles from her home, and she had never killed anything in all her life. But the little woman evidently expected her to answer, so Dorothy said with hesitation, "You are very kind, but there must be some mistake. I have not killed anything." "Your house did anyway," replied the little old woman with a laugh. "And that is the same thing. See," she continued, pointing to the corner of the house, "there are her 2 feet still sticking out from under a block of wood." Dorothy looked and gave a little cry of fright. There indeed, just under the corner of the great beam of the house, rested on 2 feet. The great beam of the house rested on 2 feet sticking out, shod in silver shoes with pointed toes. "But who was she?" asked Dorothy. "She was the wicked witch of the east, as I said," answered the little woman. "She has held all the Munchkins in bondage for many years, making them slave for her night and day. Now they are all set free, and they're very grateful to you for the favor." Dorothy says she wants to go home, but neither Glinda the Good nor the Munchkins can help. They suggest she go see the Great Oz. Now, actually, Glinda could, this witch of the north, good witch of the north, could have told her the secret then and there. But she knows, because of some magic that she performs, that Dorothy needs to make the journey to Oz, needs to learn what she has to learn. And Glinda says to Dorothy, "Oz is a good wizard. Whether he is a man or not, I cannot tell, for I have never seen him." Is Maya a man or a woman? No. We have never seen Maya. "How can I get there?" asked Dorothy. "You must walk. It is a long journey through a country that is sometimes pleasant and sometimes dark and terrible. However, I will use all the magic arts I know of to keep you from harm." So the Divine Feminine, in the form of Glinda, remember, the Divine Feminine, as it says in the Chandi, "O Devi, you are, O Mother, you are the great Devi, as also the great Asuri." So the Asuri aspect, the wicked witch of the east, has been killed. But she's in the presence of the Divine Feminine as Glinda. And so she says, "I will use all the magic arts I know of to keep you from harm." "Won't you go with me?" pleaded the little girl, who had begun to look upon the little old woman as her only friend. notice now. No, I cannot do that, she replied. But I will give you my kiss, and no one will dare injure a person who has been kissed by the wicked witch of the... No one will dare injure a person who has been kissed by the witch of the north. She came close to Dorothy and kissed her gently on the forehead. Where her lips touched the little girl, they left a round, shining mark, as Dorothy found out soon after. She left her with a tilak on her forehead. The road to the City of Emeralds is paved with yellow brick, said the witch, so you cannot miss it. When you get to Oz, do not be afraid of him, but tell your story and ask him to help you. Goodbye, my dear. Follow the yellow brick road. And if you, those of you who've seen the movie, remember that becomes a merry little song. Follow the yellow brick road. So on to chapter 3, how Dorothy saved the Scarecrow. Now, the assertion here, from here, not just from here, but from the other things that I read to you, is that Dorothy is allegorically the karma yoga aspect. We've already heard that she's harmless, that she's innocent. But she is also remarkably selfless. She's been given this great treasure. Oh, I can go find Oz and he will help me with what I want done. Does she keep that treasure to herself? As we'll see, she does not. She's quite selfless. Dorothy has been walking along. This is from chapter 3. She's been walking along the road, and she's stopped to have something to eat. There was a great cornfield beyond the fence, and not far away she saw a scarecrow placed high on a pole to keep the birds from the ripe corn. Dorothy leaned her chin upon her hand and gazed thoughtfully at the scarecrow. Its head was a small sack stuffed with straw, with eyes, nose, and mouth painted on it to represent its face. And its body was raised above the stalks of corn by means of a pole stuck up its back. While Dorothy was looking earnestly into this queer painted face of the scarecrow, she was surprised to see one of its eyes slowly wink at her. She thought she must have been mistaken at first, for none of the scarecrows in Kansas ever winked. But presently the figure nodded its head to her in a friendly way. "Good day," said the scarecrow in a rather husky voice. I told you, Baum was fond of puns. In a rather husky voice. "Did you speak?" asked the girl in wonder. "Certainly," asked the scarecrow. "How do you do?"
I get it. It took a second for me to get that. Husk of corn. Okay.
"Certainly," answered the scarecrow. "How do you do?" "I'm pretty well, thank you," replied Dorothy politely. "How do you do?" "I'm not feeling well," said the scarecrow with a smile, "for it's a very tedious thing being perched up here all night and day to scare away crows. If you will please take away the pole, I shall be greatly obliged to you." Now, it has been established already in the narrative, I haven't read that part, but it's been established already that the scarecrow isn't working to scare away the crows. The birds of Oz talk to one another, and a wise old crow had come along and found out the scarecrow was just a stuffed creature, and told the other crows, "Don't pay any attention to him." So it isn't that like the crow is evading the scarecrow is evading his duty here. he knows perfectly well he's not doing anything that is useful. Dorothy reached up both arms and lifted the figure off the pole, for being stuffed with straw, it was quite light. "Thank you very much," said the Scarecrow when he had been set down on the ground. "I feel like a new man." Dorothy was puzzled at this, for it sounded queer to hear a stuffed man speak and to see him bow and walk along beside her. "Who are you?" asked the Scarecrow, "and where are you going?" "My name is Dorothy," said the girl, "and I am going to the Emerald City to ask the Great Oz to send me back to Kansas." "Where is the Emerald City?" he inquired, "and who is Oz?" "Why, don't you know?" she returned in surprise. "No, indeed, I don't know anything. You see, I am stuffed, so I have no brains at all," he answered sadly. As we'll see, allegorically, the Scarecrow represents Jnana Yoga, the intellect, the ability to see clearly and act accordingly. He's kind of comical in a way because he doesn't have much common sense. Having just been born, it's hard. He learns his common sense. But he's very, very smart. He already has, as you'll see, what he thinks he needs to go to Oz to find. "Oh," said Dorothy, "I'm awfully sorry for you." "Do you think," he asked, "if I go to the Emerald City with you, that Oz would give me some brains?" "I cannot tell," she returned. Here's her generosity. "I cannot tell," she returned, "but you may come with me if you like. If Oz will not give you any brains, you will not be any worse off than you are now." "That is true," said the Scarecrow. "But I do not want people to call me a fool. And if my head stays stuffed with straw instead of with brains, as yours is now, how am I ever going to know anything?" "I understand how you feel," said the little girl, who was truly sorry for him. "If you will come with me, I'll ask Oz to do what he can for you." So now we have Dorothy's second companion. The first companion, of course, is Toto, who has come with her. And as I said, Toto plays a very instrumental role throughout the story in doing remarkable things that only something as simple and straightforward as a little dog could do. So Dorothy now has her second companion. Oh, and Toto, of course, does not become transformed, because being everything, how could he be transformed? Chapter 4 is the road through the forest. They encounter some adventures that test the Scarecrow's mettle, but just in consideration of time, we won't go there. We'll go on to chapter 5. The adoption, because it is an adoption, of her third companion. And that chapter is called The Rescue of the Tin Woodman. When Dorothy had finished her meal, that she spends the night in the woodman's cabin. She doesn't know it's the woodman's cabin. They just find this little cabin beside the road, she and the Scarecrow, and so she needs a place to sleep. She goes and spends the night in the cabin. There's no one there. When Dorothy had finished her meal, breakfast, and was about to go back to the road of yellow brick, she was startled to hear a deep groan nearby. "What was that?" she asked timidly. "I cannot imagine," replied the Scarecrow, "but we can go and see." Just then another groan reached their ears, and the sound seemed to come from behind them. They turned and walked through the forest a few steps when Dorothy discovered something shining in a ray of sunshine that fell between the trees. One of these big trees had been partly chopped through, and standing beside it with an uplifted axe in his hands was a man made entirely of tin. He stood perfectly motionless, as he could not stir, as he could not stir at all. He stood perfectly motionless, as if he could not stir at all. Dorothy looked at him in amazement, and so did the Scarecrow. "Did you groan?" asked Dorothy. "Yes," answered the Tin Man, "I did. I have been groaning for more than a year, and no one has ever heard me before or come to help me." "What can I do for you?" she inquired softly. "Get an oil can and oil my joints," he answered. "They are rusted so badly that I cannot move them at all. If I am well oiled, I shall soon be all right again. You will find an oil can on the shelf in my cottage." Dorothy at once ran back to the cottage and found the oil can. "Oil my neck first," replied the Tin Woodman. So she oiled it, and then the man could turn his head by himself. "Now oil the joints in my arms," he said. When Dorothy oiled them, the Tin Man gave a sigh of satisfaction and lowered his axe, which he leaned against a tree. "This is a great comfort," he said. "Now if you will oil the joints of my legs, I shall be all right once more." So she and the Scarecrow together oiled his legs until he could move them freely, and he thanked them again and again for his release, for he seemed a very polite creature and very grateful. "I might have stood there always if you had not come along," he said. "So you have certainly saved my life. How do you happen to be here?" So before we answer that question, we'll go to how did the Tin Woodman become the Tin Woodman? The Tin Woodman, the one seeking a heart, as we'll see, has an abundance of heart. He is so kind and considerate and loving. But he believes he's been robbed of his heart because the way he became a Tin Woodman, he had been a Munchkin. But he fell in love with a Munchkin girl that was under the Wicked Witch of the East's control. And the Wicked Witch of the East did not want to let her go. And so she put a spell on this Munchkin Woodman that caused him to lose each of his limbs one by one, even his head, even his torso. And they were replaced by a Munchkin tinsmith. It's really an interesting part of the story, too long for us to read this morning. But it really is interesting to see how it was love not divine love, but we would say human love or Munchkin love that cost him his ability to do what he wanted. Misplaced love. Now, it's a hard lesson, but as Swami Prabhavananda pointed out, this is one of the aphorisms that I really treasure of Swami Prabhavananda. This is the quote, "As I have told you many times, I know you do not want to hear it, but as I've told you many times, the only one who is truly your own is the Lord." And so it's not that human love is wrong in any way, but it is part of what keeps us here. So this is what the woodman had lost, his ability to be human or Munchkin. They're a form of human. Because of his unwillingness to give up a love that was costing him his life. So now, Here we hear more from the woodman. "I might have stood there always if you had not come along," he said. "So you have certainly saved my life. How did you happen to be here?" "We are on our way to the Emerald City to see the Great Oz," she answered, "and we stopped at your cottage to pass the night." "Why do you wish to see Oz?" he asked. "I want him to send me back to Kansas, and the Scarecrow wants him to put a few brains into his head," she replied. The Tin Woodman appeared to think deeply for a moment. Then he said, "Do you suppose Oz could give me a heart?" "Why, I guess so," Dorothy answered. "It would be as easy as to give the Scarecrow brains." "True," the Tin Woodman returned. "So if you will allow me to be in your party, I'll also go to the Emerald City and Oz, and ask Oz to help me." "Come along," said the Scarecrow heartily. And Dorothy added that she would be pleased to have his company. So the Tin Woodman shouldered his axe, and they all passed through the forest until they came to the road that was paved with yellow bricks. So now we have Karma Yoga in the form of Dorothy, Jnana Yoga in the form of the Scarecrow, and Bhakti in the form of the Tin Woodman. So all three of these are now represented, and now we come to the fifth companion and the fourth yoga, chapter 6, the Cowardly Lion. The lion who does not believe he has courage. Dorothy and her companions had been walking through the thick woods. Now and then there came a deep growl from some wild animal hidden among the trees. These sounds made the little girl's heart beat fast, for she did not know what made them, but Toto knew, and he walked close to Dorothy's side and did not even bark in return. "How long will it be," the child asked of the Tin Woodman, "before we're out of the forest?" "I cannot tell," was the answer. "But I am not afraid as long as I have my oil can, and nothing can hurt the Scarecrow. While you bear upon your forehead the mark of the good witch's kiss, and that will protect you from harm." "But Toto," said the little girl anxiously, "what will protect him?" "We must protect him ourselves if he is in danger," replied the Tin Woodman with heart. Just as he spoke, there came from the forest a terrible roar, and the next moment a great lion bounded into the road. Little Toto, now that he had an enemy to face, ran barking toward the lion. And the great beast had opened his mouth to bite the dog when Dorothy, fearing Toto would be killed and heedless of danger, rushed forward and slapped the lion on his nose as hard as she could, while she cried out, "Don't you dare bite Toto! You ought to be ashamed of yourself, you big beast like you, to bite a poor little dog." "I didn't bite him," said the lion, as he rubbed his nose with his paw where Dorothy had hit it. "No, but you tried to," she retorted. "You are nothing but a big coward." "I know it," said the lion, hanging his head in shame. "Perhaps," said the lion thoughtfully, "if I had no heart, I should not be a coward." "Have you any brains?" asked the Scarecrow. "I suppose so. I've never looked to see," replied the lion. "I'm going to the Great Oz to ask him to give me some," remarked the Scarecrow, "for my head is stuffed with straw." "And I'm going to ask him to give me a heart," said the woodman. "And I'm going to ask him to send Toto and me back to Kansas," added Dorothy. "Do you think Oz would give me courage?" asked the cowardly lion. Just as easily as he could give me brains, said the Scarecrow, or give me a heart, said the Tin Woodman, or send me back to Kansas, said Dorothy. Then, if you don't mind, I'll go with you, said the Lion, for my life is simply unbearable without a bit of courage. You will be very welcome, answered Dorothy, for you will help to keep away other wild beasts. It seems to me they must be more cowardly than you if they allow you to scare them so easily. They really are, said the Lion, but that does not make me any braver. As long as I know myself to be a coward, I shall be very unhappy. Now, earlier in the chapter, earlier than this particular little paragraph I just read, the Lion has said how easy it is for him to frighten the other animals of the forest away. He just has to roar at them, and even the munchkins and other beings of the forest run away when he utters his big growl. But he still doesn't understand that just to do things like jump into the yellow brick road ahead of them is courageous. He thinks because things run away so easily, it makes him cowardly. He doesn't understand that this king of beasts possesses the power that he already possesses, the great power of Raja Yoga. He's the allegory for Raja Yoga. And as the story develops, we see just how courageous he is, just how compassionate the woodman is, just how smart and capable of great deep understanding the Scarecrow is, and of course how Dorothy always has the power to do what it is that she thinks she wants to do. Here's just one example of what I mean about, and this is about the woodman. It's from chapter 7, The Journey to the Great Oz. Chapter 7, The Journey to the Great Oz. During the rest of the day, there was no other adventure to mar the peace of their journey. Once, indeed, the Tin Woodman stepped upon a beetle that was crawling along the road and killed the poor little thing. This made the Tin Woodman very unhappy, for he was always careful not to hurt any living creature, and as he walked along, he wept several tears of sorrow and regret. This is the heartless woodman who practices ahimsa, won't harm any creature. So now we have our party. We have Dorothy, this generous, selfless little girl who doesn't understand that she has the power to realize her wish. We have Toto, who is this little creature who is instrumental in so many things as the story evolves. We have the Scarecrow, who is seeking wisdom, really, the ability to understand things deeply and not be a fool, not understanding that he already possesses it. This is the theme of this story, and that Baum took directly from Vivekananda. We already possess everything. Education is nothing but, Vivekananda said, education is nothing other than the revelation, the discovery of the perfection of already in man. Education is nothing more than the discovery, the revelation of the perfection already in man. So we have the Tin Man, who thinks that he needs a physical heart. But he embodies great heart, great compassion. And the Cowardly Lion, who is, we see as the story evolves, is courageous in every sense and does many courageous acts completely spontaneously and uncalculated. So we have our party together now. So now we go on to chapter 8, The Deadly Poppy Field. Now we begin to encounter the obstacles to realization of our true inner being. The deadly poppy field, of course, is emblematic of tamas, of the ability of things like opium poppies. These are opium poppies. This is why it's called the deadly poppy field. And opium and alcohol and all of these things that can be an impediment to our, to just slow us down. This deadly poppy field puts them all to sleep. All but the Tin Woodman. Puts them all to sleep. But they aren't rescued by the Tin Woodman. He's instrumental in creating the ability for them to be rescued. But it's the Queen of the Field Mice. This tiny creature and her thousands of subjects. She's the queen. They're the ones who, using the wood that the woodman cuts, they build this conveyance, a wheeled raft, if you will, to convey these people, to take those who are sleeping out of the field. And it's very interesting, if we look closely at the story and the way the Queen of the Field Mice and her followers, it's little things that save us. Little actions that save us. It's not big resolutions. It's little daily activities. It takes a while for the field mice to get this conveyance built with the woodman's help. And so they're conveyed out of the poppy field. And that is chapter 9, The Queen of the Field Mice. And they find that once they are past this poppy field, they're not very far from Oz. And so they come to the walled city of Oz. They follow the yellow brick road and they get there. But of course there's a guardian of the gate into Oz. And they have to get past this fellow. And this is where, I won't go into all the details, but this is where the scarecrow's wit comes in. He is able to solve the problem of how to get them past the guardian of the gate. And so they get into, this is the next chapter, chapter 11, The Wonderful City of Oz. Now, Oz is the creation of Maya. It is all an illusion. The city itself, this green, glimmering city, is all an illusion. It exists because people believe it exists because the people who live there believe it exists, as we find through this story. That's the only reason it exists. And at its heart, of course, is this one that they're looking for. So they go into the city of Oz, and they encounter Oz. But the first thing they encounter, of course, they haven't discovered who he really is yet. And he says, I'll give you all what you want, but you have to accomplish this great task. Now, this is, if you know the story of the hero's journey, there's always a great task that must be accomplished, one that must be accomplished intentionally. Joseph Campbell, in his book, The Masks of God and others, his stories, his mythological studies, says that this is one of the great identifying features. And so what does Oz tell them? There's one remaining enemy. You've killed the Wicked Witch of the East. There's one remaining enemy. You must kill the Wicked Witch of the West. And so the story goes then from they leave the city and search for the Wicked Witch. They have adventures and misadventures. They're rescued. They finally find the Wicked Witch. If you remember from the movie, those of you who've seen the movie, the winged monkeys, they're quite different in this story. They are enthralled. They are in the thrall of the Wicked Witch of the West. They're not evil beings at all. And so they actually are instrumental not only in taking Dorothy and her friends to the Wicked Witch, but they also are instrumental in her rescue. And so if you remember in the introduction to Dorothy, she cannot kill anything. She's completely given to harmlessness, ahimsa. So when she encounters the Wicked Witch, and manages to kill her, it is not an act of malice. It's an act of generosity. The Wicked Witch has managed to set herself on fire by trying to put Toto in the fire. So Dorothy picks up a pail of water and throws the pail of water on her, not knowing that water was inimical to this wicked being. The purity of the water dissolves the Wicked Witch. If you remember in the movie, she says, I'm melting, I'm melting, and she withers away. So once again, Dorothy destroys evil, but not as an act of war, not as an act of vengeance, not as an act of cruelty, but as an act of generosity. She's actually trying to save her and the dog. So now they've accomplished their task, their great task, and they go back to Oz. And then is when the chapter is called The Discovery of Oz the Terrible. And it's Toto that pulls aside the curtain. Toto runs up and pulls aside the curtain and shows, it's this very lovely scene in the movie, you know, where the character behind the curtain, Oz, says, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. But he's been discovered. He's been, you know, here he is, just this little kind of peculiar fellow who's created this great illusion with all of his levers and mechanisms and so on that they had been fooled by before when they came to ask him for what they came, each of them came to ask for, and he sent them on their quest to kill the Wicked Witch. So now they have they've discovered that he's a fraud. And the next chapter, of course, is titled the magical art of the great humbug. The great humbug being Maya. And so Baum goes into great detail about how Maya, how this humbug creates the illusions that keep us imprisoned in our ignorance. But they still say, give us what we came for. So the scarecrow's head is stuffed with a different kind of straw. And of course he doesn't know that this is what's happened. But he thinks, now I have what I came for. I have my brains. He's not any different at all, really. The Tin Man is given this mechanical heart that ticks. Fits around his neck on a lanyard. And tick, 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 tick. Now I have a heart. He got what he came for. The Cowardly Lion, it's a medallion. Beautiful, great ribbon with a gold medallion. Saying, courage. So now he has courage. Though he's been courageous all along. But what about Dorothy? How's Dorothy going to get home to Kansas? Well, Oz, having been discovered, says, well, I'll take you in my balloon. And so they get all together to go in the balloon. And, of course, it goes wrong. Oz gets in the balloon, inflates this hot air balloon, gets in the balloon, and gets in the basket under the balloon, and Dorothy is about to get in, but once again, Toto is instrumental. Toto runs away. So she goes after him, and the mooring to the balloon breaks, and the balloon sails away. No way to bring it back. Dorothy is abandoned. Now the four of them get together in the Oz, the five of them, Toto included, get together in Oz's throne room. And it's decided that they will go and find the Good Witch and see if she can help her. But they decide someone must rule over this city of illusion that has been created, because the people still believe in it. It still exists. The people of the city of Oz still believe in it, so it still exists. So they say, one of us must stay here and rule over it. So the first transformation is the scarecrow becomes the ruler of Oz. Gianna becomes the master of Maya. It's really a very touching scene. Gianna is, and the people of Oz are delighted that they have this new and wise king. So the other four now, Toto, Dorothy, the Tin Man, and the Lion, go off in search of Glinda. So they encounter, the chapter titles are How the Balloon Was Launched, and then Away to the South to find the other Good Witch. That's right. They go looking for the other Good Witch. And, of course, once again, they encounter obstacles. This time now, they're on their self-appointed task of getting Dorothy home. And the first thing that happens to them is they're attacked by the fighting trees. The forces of nature themselves come forward to try to stop them. Attacked by the fighting trees. They survive this, of course, partly by the woodman's skill with his axe and so on. Then they come to this place, and it's so... I encourage you to read this book, because it is the dainty... This chapter title is The Dainty China Country. And everything is so pretty, and everything is so perfect, and the food is so good, and everything is just done so perfectly by these dainty China people. Now, I don't think he was pointing to the country of China precisely, but there may have been something in that, in the way that the Chinese do things so artfully and aesthetically and so on. But it is, again, an impediment. One has to get past them, and they don't want you to go. They want you to stay. So they get past this. And then the second transformation of one of Dorothy's companions. The chapter is titled "The Lion Becomes the King of the Beasts." They go into this forest that is under the thrall of a giant spider. A giant spider. This isn't in the movie. A lot of this isn't in the movie. This giant spider is all of the creatures of the forest. The elephants, the crocodiles, every one of them is afraid of this giant spider. So who kills the spider? The cowardly lion. And he becomes because now the denizens of the forest have been freed. They say, "We want you to be king of the forest." So the lion is now transformed and becomes the king of beasts. Next chapter: the country of the Quadling. We once again run into the impediment of the dark force of Tamas. These are creatures who will stand in your way and keep you from going forward for no reason whatsoever, except their habits and their ways. As Emerson pointed out, consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. These are people of small minds and great strength. And they will stop you simply because they don't want you to change anything. Well, through the good graces of the Tin Man and so on, they manage to get through this. And now when they reach the south, they find that the Good Witch is not there. Something has happened to her. And the Tin Man, he rules over the good kingdom of the South. This is where he is transformed. His love of everything, of everyone and everything, allows him to take charge of the realm of the South. So now what is Dorothy to do? Well, the winged monkeys. I told you the winged monkeys were not, and they have been freed because the Wicked Witch of the West has been killed. They fetch Glinda. They go and tell Glinda what's happened, the Good Witch of the North. And Glinda comes. And Glinda says, Dorothy, you've had the power to go home all along. Those ruby slippers in the movie, silver shoes in the story, they had the power to take you home all the time. And she tells her how to use them. Nothing complicated. And Dorothy then is once again whirled. There's this whirling is part of the experience of illumination. Dorothy, according to the story, Dorothy is whirled up and set down in the field with Toto. She's holding Toto in her arms. And she's home again. We're not told in the story how Dorothy sees her home again. But you can imagine, having been transformed by this experience, that she sees it very differently. All we're told is that she sees Uncle Henry working away with the cows. So this is the story of the four yogas woven into this beautiful, beautiful fairy tale. And I really do encourage each of you to read the book. It's just, he really is a great writer. It deserves the fact of its bestsellership all these years. But this, as I said, the theme of the story is that each of us contains already the knowledge, the power, the capability to be fully ourselves. And as Swami Ranganathananda pointed out in his book, Divine Grace, to be fully human is to be fully divine. So, that's the story bound told. And the characters that he created out of his understanding of Swamiji's Raja Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Karma Yoga, and Raja Yoga. And when asked how he came to write this book, he said, I really don't know. He said, it seems that the great author, capital G, capital A, seems that the great author chooses an instrument, and it happens. Though, if you read the story of how it was created, it was really quite an interesting series of incidents. Just finding the illustrator and the illustrations, I so wish I had been able to show them to you, and I hope that you'll look online and see them. He fought with the illustrator to make sure that, because something had given him the vision of how these characters should be. So I'm just speaking personally, I'm very grateful to Vivekananda and Frank Baum for having produced this wonderful story. And thanks for listening as I told it this morning. What has this given rise to in you? What kind of questions do you have as a result of having heard all this? Or what comments would you like to make? Yes, Larissa.
The color of the road itself.
Yes.
Yellow, Would that be love?
It is as described. If you look at the Dalai Lama's robes, they're a kind of a maroon color and a yellow color. That's it. That golden color. It's the road to wisdom. You know, there are people who interpret this as an allegory of the fight that was going on at that time about the gold standard. You know, so the yellow brick road is the gold standard, and we have to follow the yellow brick road, the gold standard. I think that's nonsense, but nevertheless, yes, I think it is an allegory for the deeply, the path of love, the path of adventure towards spiritual realization. It's if you read the book, you'll find that it's not always smooth. It's not always easy. Sometimes it's quite bumpy and broken up, and it's, you can still follow it. You can still see it, but it's not the Scarecrow and the Tin Man both have trouble sometimes navigating it. They fall down. Anybody else? Yes, Brian.
Did Vivekananda ever talk about the effects of opium or alcohol?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Absolutely. He forbade them from the monasteries. And they're part of the rules, that the order, you cannot have intoxicants in the monastery. The only one that was allowed was tobacco at the time. But yes, he didn't inveigh against it. He didn't, you know, make a big deal out of it. He just said, you know, this, it just is an impediment to...
It's an impediment to spiritual
life. Yeah. And not only to spiritual life, but to the actualization of your karma yogic self. You know, your the ability to work servicefully for others. If you're, you know, in a tamasic state, you're not going to do much. Yes?
Yeah, they all listen to their inner questions. So maybe that is the first sign of a spiritual awakening.
But the first sign of spiritual awakening is?
Like each one of them, they listen or like ask themselves some questions.
Yes.
And that gave them the courage to take that journey. And that is the first sign of spiritual awakening.
Very good, very good. Yes, the first sign of spiritual awakening is questioning the state in which you're already in. This can't be all of it. There must be more.
To know what you want.
Hmm?
I mean, for me, it's like to know what you want. That is the biggest,
yes, yes,
challenge here.
Yes, and then discover that you already possess it. Hmm. You can't know about it. This is what Vivekananda asserts. You can't even know about it if you don't already possess it. That the knowledge itself, that it's there, is proof of its existence within you. It only has to be manifested. And then there are these tools, which he said, work or worship or psychic control or philosophy, by one or more or all four. Do the work and be free. So he left us these tools for that purpose. And of course, he didn't invent them. He, like all great teachers, he organized them. All of the great teachers who aren't, he made his own contributions, but the yogas all pre-existed. He formalized them. But it's a very good point. The knowledge is there. We have to know what we want. But as Vivekananda pointed out, the fact that we know what we want is proof that the power and the knowledge is already there. Yes?
What did you say, the kiss of the good witch on her forehead, what did that represent?
Well, we can say from the tradition of India, this is a tilak. This is a significant, you know, we see all kinds of different things are painted on the forehead in India and elsewhere because there is something special. I mean, when the pharaoh's crown was put on his head, what came out of right here? The serpent power. The serpent power came out of this.
Third eye.
Yes, the third eye. So the eye of wisdom, the eye of power. So this is all very much a... But the fact that it's conferred by the good witch of the north, Glinda, indicates that we can have allies in our and protection in our spiritual journey. She said she'd use all her, and Dorothy is never harmed. In all of this, you know, it comes close, things happen, but Dorothy is never harmed. Yes, Paul.
I think of a Hatha yoga.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is there some? Did Frank Baum have any interest in that, or is that reflected in the Wizard of Oz story in any way?
Hatha yoga. It's interesting. Hatha yoga is its emphasis. Its great emphasis is something that came about in the 20th century. Vivekananda. It's asana in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. And as the Swami pointed out on Saturday morning, it's very much a... I guess it was Friday night. He talked about the four aspects. He mentioned it again on Saturday morning. Asana is to make the body fit and strong. It's not an end in itself. It's really... The point of it is to enable you to sit for a long time in meditation, that the body is strong enough and fit enough that you can sit calmly and the body will maintain itself nicely and calmly. So Hatha Yoga is not, I didn't identify in any case, any direct reference to it. All these yoga studios that now abound, this is the dawn of people becoming interested in that which will take them further. I mean, It's the ground floor. It's those four things that the Swami mentioned. We have to gain some mastery of those before we can have the calmness necessary to concentrate, and then concentration turns into meditation. As long as the mind is agitated and the body is uncomfortable, hopeless condition. The only thing worse is being hungry. We can't meditate when we're hungry.
The Swami spoke about the drunken monkey.
Ah, yes.
That has been also stung by a scorpion.
Yes.
And is in no condition to enter samadhi, you know, to sit and quietly contemplate.
Right. Not even begin that task. Yeah. Right.
So maybe the Hatha yoga is a way to begin to calm the monkey down.
It just think of what's necessary when you practice Hatha Yoga. You have to learn how to control your body. The body and the mind are not separate things. You're learning to control your mind when you're learning to control your body. And you gain great mental poise as well as physical poise from learning how to perform these wonderful... The people who've evolved Hatha Yoga from what is suggested as in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, they really know what they're doing. Now, it becomes, as Vivekananda said, you have to be careful about going too far in that direction because then it puts too much emphasis on the body and reinforces our belief, I am the body. If you see it as just a tool toward gaining mastery over the body and the beginning of the mastery over the mind, there's a whole lot more to gaining mastery of the mind than will be yielded by the asanas. But it is certainly a wonderful beginning in that direction. because you simply can't do the asanas well and gracefully if you haven't some control of your mind. Yes, Uma?
Not to me. Besides all the allegorical representation of each character, the character of Oz at the end, hiding behind the curtain, eludes you, representing Maya. And that, to me, is most important, I mean, in my opinion. Because this journey of self-transformation, she had to take it, even if to know at the end that it was all Maya. So until you break the bubble of Maya, you don't realize the truth about yourself.
Nope. Exactly.
And that Oz character is like showing you, tempting you, you know, there is something at the end. But then the whole bubble bursts. And it is through your experience. It was already there, but you had to go through that journey and lose it as if.
Yes.
To find yourself.
Yes, precisely. We exist in this human form because we want to. Why do we want to? So that we can experience this journey of self-discovery. This is just as evident as it can possibly be, that we want to be human so that we can experience so fully the journey to self-discovery.
My question, there is another classic we all know, Alice in Wonderland. Is there any parallel between that story and this story?
Only in that Vivekananda remarked, he didn't know about, at least we have no evidence that he knew about the wonderful Wizard of Oz. But he did know about Alice in Wonderland. And he said that Lewis Carroll had the greatest grasp of the human mind of any writer he had ever encountered. How the mind works and how Maya plays on it. So there's that connection, but I don't think there's any direct connection in Vivekananda's thinking or writing that I know of that makes any connection between the two. But he was a great admirer of Lewis Carroll and really thought that the Jabberwocky, for example, was just hilariously funny because of the way it pranks how our mind actually does that. You know. Yes, Bhagirath.
This is a classic, and the classic can be interpreted in a number of ways.
Yes.
That way, your initial statement that one should go through fairy tales is very good, because a fairy tale will be interpreted according to your state of mind.
Yes.
So, simple thing for children, I would say, the story shows that the whole consists of parts. And the parts only when together makes it a whole. They are interdependent. Each part should be fully used. Because we know very well now, we use 30% of our brain. And now it's coming out.
What we seem to, anyway.
What seem to, yes. It's also coming out, our heart, we are not using it adequately. Some part we. So when everything is put together in a harmonious way, then we make it together, and that means you have reached your ultimate point. Ultimate point, like someone said in the back, you will not recognize unless you know what that ultimate point is. And that is something which is happening right now to our civilization. As long as it's a perfect body, we say it's wonderful. So let's take exercise and gyms and that thing to make the body very perfect. But what do you want to do with that perfect body? Nobody has the answer.
Vivekananda has the answer.
That is why first you have to recognize what your home is.
Yes.
So that when you reach your home, then you know it is your home. Yes. Otherwise you will not even know it.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. So yes, our journey is, the wonderful part of it is both simultaneously preordained and not preordained. You know, the individual incidents of our journey will be suited to our, just the goal is preordained. This is what the teachers say. Yes?
I think this is Swami was saying all about Yama and Niyamas.
Yes.
All these Yamas and Niyamas are nothing but the Dharma.
Yes.
And Dorothy was following, whether she knows it or not,
mm-hmm.
she was following the Dharma at every step.
Yes.
And that is the reason she was never harmed.
Yes.
So whether in this Maya also, we have to follow the Dharma that will lead us to the right path and right place.
Yes, absolutely. It is a formula. There's no two ways about it. It does not guarantee that we won't be harmed. But if we're following Dharma, even if we're harmed, we won't see it in the same way. Even if some harm comes to us, we won't see
but
it or experience.
Harms are also, it's a seeming harms, but not real.
That's what I was driving at. Yes, exactly. The Atman, as Krishna says so eloquently in chapter 2 of the Gita, is invulnerable. And Vivekananda speculates, or doesn't speculate, but remarks on that when he says, stand as a rock. You are indestructible. You are the Self, the God of the universe. But which of us sitting here can say that we really know that from conviction? We know that Vivekananda said it, but as Sri Ramakrishna proved, when people would, you know, assert that too strongly, he would give them a real pinch and say, yes, you felt the pinch. You know, don't tell me it isn't real. You felt the pinch. So we become invulnerable when we know who we truly are. Then we can be like that sadhu who sat there and laughed at Alexander the Great when Alexander the Great said he was going to kill him. The sadhu simply laughed out loud and said, go right ahead. You may kill this body, but you've killed nothing. He wasn't afraid. Alexander the Great was absolutely overwhelmed. He'd never encountered anyone who laughed at his threat to pull his sword and kill his head off. Literally laughed aloud. That's because the sadhu knew the truth of himself. I'm not sure if, you know, Alexander the Great rode in here on his horse and pulled his sword, that any of us would be able to say that in the same way that the sadhu did. So we have a ways to go. We have a ways to go. But as you pointed out, Balakrishnaji, she was protected by Dharma. Glinda the Good was in the embodiment of Dharma, yes. And was always there working in the background. Anybody else?
He's partly answered the question, but could he tell us some more about, he said there's a preordained goal, and you know that, but a little bit more about destiny. Destiny,
your destiny is to become a fully realized soul. Your destiny is to become one with that which is. How that happens to each of us is going to be as individual as we are. We are not cut from a cookie cutter. Just look at us in this room. Each one of us, so very different. So very different. That individuality, that uniqueness, is a reflection of our true inner nature. The infinite cannot be contained into a form. It'll express itself in any number of forms. Any number. Krishna says to Arjuna in the Gita, you've only seen just a tiny fraction. I've given you this full vision of everything and you can only see even just a tiny fraction. This is what we need to internalize, is that we are at this moment just a tiny little objectification of the infinite. We are infinite dreamers, Vivekananda speaking. We are infinite dreamers speaking, and we are infinite dreamers dreaming finite dreams. This particular finite dream, our infinitude, we will ultimately realize. That's the only word we can use for it. We can't say understand it or know it, because those are all, they all presuppose a knower, an experiencer. Realization is something beyond that. So our destiny is that. But the pathway to that destiny, as Ram Dass said, the one who wrote the book Be Here Now, that fellow Ram Dass, he said, you know, if we look at it closely, we'll see all we're doing is walking one another home. Each of us here is walking the rest of us home. We're all together on this journey. And, you know, here we are this Sunday morning on this journey. How wonderful. How truly wondrous. And we heard about a different kind of wondrous journey. So, our destiny is preordained, because that's what we want. We want that. The word and I've come to treasure it more and more, the Sanskrit word kaivalya, independence. Independence means not dependent on anything or thought or feeling or perception. Not dependent on any object whatsoever. Independent. This is our destiny. In the meantime, we are dependent. And the more we acknowledge it, and the more we behave, as Balakrishna pointed out, as if we are dependent on Dharma, the yamas and the niyamas and all that portends. Because if we stray outside of that, you could say it's bad and wrong. That's kind of nonsense. It's just kind of a waste of time. But if we see it as something else, who's to argue with you? As long as you're not harming others, ahimsa is number one. As long as you're not harming others, as Sri Ramakrishna said, go enjoy the world. I have no objection. But when you are sick of it, return to me. I have the cure. And so the cure is what's talked about here in its various ways, week after week after week, because that's what we want. Those of us who come here, we've come for the cure. So the Swami spoke to us Friday night, Saturday morning. He talked about, if you're going to prepare your cure, you know, if you're going to do the preparation, get out your mortar and pestle and grind up the powders and so on and so forth for the cure, you better have the yamas and the niyamas in that mix, because otherwise you simply will not have a calm enough mind and body to go ahead and learn what you need to learn, which is contemplation, concentration, and meditation. So our destiny is foreordained or preordained, but the pathway there is anything but.
It is kind of very interesting that when we say destiny, the word is somewhat obscure. But when we say destination, then it's a sure word.
Right.
So ultimately the real destiny is to reach real destination. And that's our Vedanta.
It's interesting. Yes, you're absolutely right. And it's interesting, John Tagney, who visits here from time to time, says, jokingly, he puts a spin on it by saying, we are all doomed to illumination. We are all doomed to illumination. Doom simply means destiny. It doesn't mean anything dark. We've come to think of it that way. But that's a connotation, not the denotation. So we are all doomed to illumination. Yes, preordained, right.
But
yes, Balakrishna.
Even though we know the destination, but in order to reach the destination, we come across so many hurdles. So every time the word destiny comes into my mind, I think about Bhagavad Gita.
Mm-hmm.
Because Krishna was there at every moment to tell Arjuna what is his destiny, how it is going to work, and all those things. But we don't have a Krishna next to me. So it's always a puzzle. It's a fork. Every minute when we are going through, it's a fork. What is the right way, wrong way, and whatever it is. That's why dharma, to follow the dharma, is very important. And as Krishna said, do your best and leave the rest to me.
Balakrishna ji, you do have a Krishna with you at every moment. It's contained in your mantra. The moment you begin to say that mantra, you manifest the spiritual power that is contained in that mantra, which is the divine presence itself. And if we then focus on the mantra gives us access to the buddhi. The buddhi is behind individuation. The ahamkara that we think of ourselves as a separate being, the buddhi is underneath that, so to speak. It's not individuated. So it automatically will guide our behavior. It will automatically. This is why the great gift of this mantra is there. So you do have Krishna with you every moment, or however you want to think about the divine presence. That's there. And the moment you have yourself aligned with that, thank you two for coming this morning. So always good to see you. The moment you have yourself aligned with that, then you have access to the buddhi. The buddhi, you know, in common parlance is called our conscience. Mm-hmm. It's always there in all of us. We mostly ignore it. As Winston Churchill said, many people stumble over the truth and then get up and walk on as if nothing had happened. So it's always there. This is the power of the mantra. This is the power of the divine presence. So we always have guidance. We always, how much we ignore it, or how much we seek it, or how much we accept it, that's a moment to moment priority decision. But it's always there for us. Always there. So we'll close with our chant, and then we'll go inside to the monastery. And it occurs to me I didn't open with our opening chant. I just plunged right in this morning. I was feeling the urgency of the amount to be covered. So here's our beautiful closing chant. Let there be peace in outer space. Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
May the gods be peaceful. May the whole universe be pervaded by peace. Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. Now, I know that Jim, our benefactor, brought us I don't know whether anyone's spread it out already for us in there, but let's go in there in the monastery and see what's there for us.